Okay, we're rolling. You can play.
It so is awful hot here in Phoenix.
So, what are these mysterious flying machines?
You don't have the land of the painted desert sky.
Holy crap, look!
It was a perfect triangle just floating across the sky.
Wednesday. Where they're yet to discover or uncover the Dutchman's gold.
All right, well, we'll be keeping our eyes up on the sky.
Major Domo.
I hit tell of a fountain in Superstition Mountains.
It isn't exactly Close Encounters of the Third Kind, but
it's a story that is very well told.
This series of strange lights, which appeared in the northern Arizona sky last night, has thousands of people scratching their heads.
My name is Matt, and I'm the owner, creator, writer, editor, social media manager, and host of the world-renowned podcast, Secret Society of Fly Tires. This is my 10th episode.
10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10,
interview with myself. Who do you think you are? Anthony Bourdain? The show is already pretty loose about being a fly-tying podcast like I claim, but no, I'm not turning this into a cool travel show. I'm just having a good time learning about new places from local experts and making up fake stories to mix in with actual facts. What are you even doing? Just repeating the same jokes? Wow, yeah, kinda, I guess. Jokes keep getting funnier the more you use them, right? I keep using the same music, too. The Damned are probably in half of my episodes, and I'd expect for them, Mark Lanigan and Ian from Minor Threat to show up again in future episodes, too. I'm a routine guy, okay? I'm interviewing myself, and it's sure feeling like all these questions are really just insults. Who died and made you podcast king? Nobody, unless you count the trail of dead knitting podcast hosts I left in my dust back in July. I kind of teed that one up for myself to make yet another repeat joke. It's like the hook from a great song, right, faithful listeners?
Yes, Matt.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to let me ask me any more questions because I don't like where this is going. And maybe I've been repeating myself a little bit with three episodes in a row about rivers that weren't that far away from each other on the map. I definitely have something different for this episode. Chris Baer from AZ Fly Shop joined me for a video phone call that I'm only allowing you to hear the audio from, due to me being nude for most of it.
Oh, come on!
That's always why. We talked about all kinds of stuff. The main reason I wanted to talk to him is the focus of this episode, Phoenix, Arizona. More specifically, tying flies and fishing the Metro Canal System in Phoenix. It's an unconventional place to fly fish, and that interests me. I love the beautiful places that trout live and the breathtaking coastlines, but I love the fringe too. Fishing the canals in Phoenix definitely sounded fringe, and I needed to find out more. I mean, it's a perfect fit for my stupid show. Arizona's all kinds of weird. There's a city in Arizona that's a solid 18 square miles of magnetic vortexes. In fact, in Sedona, every homeowner has their own omnidirectional vortex. Not omnidirectional. Omnilateral.
Omniprong?
No. Multidimensional. Maybe all three of those. Phoenix is fishy, even if it doesn't sound like a traditional fly fishing destination. There's tales of the Lost Dutchman's Mine, which is said to contain a trove of hidden gold somewhere in the Superstition Mountains just east of Phoenix. There's also my own hopeful tale of revenge on the Border Patrol agents of this convection oven of a state for costing me precious time and thousands of dollars for a pointless marijuana arrest that occurred on Highway 10 on my way to Phoenix back in my rock and roll touring days. Or was it Highway 8? I don't remember, and it doesn't really matter. None of that matters. It's just filler. Filler for my life. Filler for this episode. I just used another Minor Threat sound clip. See? I told you. Anyway, I'm going to use this program to dig into Metro Canal fishing for suckers and carp with Chris Baer. But before I let you creeps eavesdrop on our chat, I want to dig into my favorite piece of weird Phoenix lore, the Phoenix Lights.
Well, we haven't answered what they are, but we do know that something strange did happen in the sky over Arizona last night. More than 100 witnesses called the UFO hotline, and at least two local people caught the strange lights on videotape.
I'm going to guess, by looking at my listener analytics, that most of you have probably heard about the Phoenix Lights. Maybe not my German listeners, though.
Hallo meine neuen Fernfreunde. Danke, dass Sie sich diese blöde Sendung angehört haben.
And there's a good chance that my listeners in the Netherlands aren't aware of the story either.
Ik ben erg opgewonden dat ik een paar Nederlandse luisteraars heb. Bedankt dat je deze domme podcast een kans hebt gegeven.
I'm 41 now, and I was 16 years old when I saw the news reports. I had already been traumatized by Whitley Strieber's communion and fire in the sky, so seeing a mass UFO sighting on the national news that actually seemed legitimate was pretty crazy for an irrationally angry high school punk version of myself who didn't care about or believe in anything besides chainsaw music. I'm going to refresh myself on the events and give you all a brief rundown of what happened, and then we'll get into tying bugs and fishing. Being a Phoenix resident, maybe Chris has a memory of it that he can share too. I'll ask him, because I always ask my guests about their paranormal experiences, because that is the kind of question guests should expect on a fly tying podcast. It's definitely information they should feel comfortable sharing with a total stranger that has plans to post it on the internet for other strangers to hear.
Does this make common sense to you? There's nothing normal about this.
So the event started on March 13, 1997. Many sightings were reported across the southwestern states for a period lasting more than 12 hours. The first being a report of a V-shaped object as big as a 747 spotted 285 miles northwest of Phoenix over Henderson, Nevada, at approximately 7:55 p.m. Thousands of witnesses from Prescott, Nevada to Tucson and even down into Mexico reported formations of lights over the valley sky that were seemingly under some kind of intelligent control throughout the night. The final report was a sighting of a second set of lights, or orbs, seen later the same night near the Sierra Estrella mountain range. I like that they referred to the lights as orbs in the last report. I told you in episode 8 with Gilligan that I'm into orbs.
There was orbs and all that stuff.
Orbs, all right. I'm into orbs, man.
Orbs of all kinds, really. I thought about listing all the orbs I'm into, but I'm not going to do that. Baseballs, mandarins, grapefruits, lots of different candies, boobs, peanut butter, Captain Crunch, the planets in the solar system, marbles, Christmas ornaments, Christmas lights, scoops of ice cream, beads. Collectively, these sightings became known as the Phoenix Lights, and it's said that 10% of Arizona residents saw them that night. There was a good reason so many people saw the Phoenix Lights on March 13, 1997. The Hale-Bopp Comet was one of the most widely observed comets of the 20th century and one of the brightest seen for many decades. Many people were going out to view the comet on a regular basis, and lots of people were going out to see it that night. The Heaven's Gate religious cult, led by the charismatic Marshall Applewhite, preached that suicide would allow them to leave their bodily containers and enter an alien spacecraft hidden behind the Hale-Bopp Comet. They bought some fancy Nike shoes for their trip and strapped in for their final ride in Rancho Santa Fe near San Diego, California.
Those who are trying to prepare themselves for entry into the evolutionary level above human, synonymous with the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven.
You can't say that this isn't a little weird, right? I joke that all the conspiracies and high strangeness come together full circle eventually, that everything is connected. If you didn't already put it together yourself, I'll spoil this whole story right now and tell you that the Phoenix Lights was the very ship that the Heaven's Gate cult was waiting for. They figured out a way to call it. They beckoned it. It really came, and it really took their souls and left their empty containers. That's the end of today's episode. Thanks for listening. Well, I'm once again going to apologize for making a bad joke when people really died, however wacky the circumstances were. I would like to say I'm sorry right here, right now, for doing that.
I'm awfully sorry.
The Phoenix Lights went viral before that meant anything other than something to do with being sick.
Man, that is sick!
Now that's just some slightly outdated slang for cool. Let's say ill instead.
It's time to get ill!
No, that means cool too, goddammit. I just mean everyone was talking about it. It was all over the news, and the UFO community took off with it quickly, too. Art Bell was talking about it on Coast to Coast AM immediately.
And oh my, what a story it is from Phoenix. The incredible sightings over the city of Phoenix recently. Bright lights in the city's March skies. something that was huge and made no noise.
The government, or Men in Black, or whatever, had to get to work quickly and make this all seem like something normal. Swamp gas, Chinese lanterns, flares, whatever. The masses will accept anything, and it'll be forgotten in a week. Arizona's then-governor, Fife Symington, that has to be a Longmont Potion Castle character, held a jokey press conference to make fun of the idea that the Phoenix Lights could be anything out of the ordinary. After declaring state officials had found the guilty party behind the sightings, his chief of staff, Jay Heiler, was perp-walked to the podium dressed as a gray alien in handcuffs before a hilarious unmasking. Everyone in the room had a good chuckle. Ha 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 ha, you fucking fools. You didn't see anything. They even had to backtrack a bit because their little press conference was so brazen and condescending. Governor Fife Symington went on to say that they weren't trying to ridicule anyone's concerns, but there was an element of building hysteria which really needed to be dealt with. He even apologized and said, I'm sorry if I offended people, but it was a lot of fun. There were people who tried to be honest about it and investigate the very high volume of sightings. Frances Emma Barwood, then a city councilwoman and vice mayor, stated in an episode of Showtime's 2021 docuseries, UFO, that her office received 700 calls asking for an investigation. She championed their cause, but at a cost. She was roasted by the media and her peers. The political cartoonist for the Republic lampooned her. She lost her council seat and later dropped out of politics. You could say trying to find the truth about the Phoenix Lights destroyed her career. She's gone on record stating that a clear video of the Phoenix Lights craft was in possession of local government officials and was taken by men in black suits. Celebrity Kurt Russell was flying his private plane in the area that night. He witnessed and reported the lights, even talked about it on late night TV. Some credit him with the first report of the Phoenix Lights I mentioned earlier.
So we're going into Phoenix and I think it was Sky Harbor, and there's these bank of lights, six lights, in the shape of a triangle going back right over the airport. And I'm looking at them as I'm coming in. I'm, you know, on the horn talking to them, and I'm coming in. And Oliver said, hey, Pa, what are those lights? And I said, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what they are. And so anyway, I called up the tower and I said, what are you guys painting tonight over the airport? And they said, we're not showing anything. What are you seeing? I said, well, there's six lights in a row. And they said, do you want to report this? And I said, I can't identify it. It's flying and it's six objects.
He even described what sounded like kind of a joint brainwashing where Kurt and his son both hadn't thought about it or mentioned it to anyone until years after the event. It didn't even seem like he mentioned it to his wife, Goldie Hawn, who has gone on record with her own paranormal and UFO experiences. You would think he would have told her, probably right when he got home from seeing the UFO from his airplane. But did you know that around a decade after the Phoenix Lights mass sighting, Governor Fife Symington had a little change of heart? In 2007, he started claiming in interviews that he gave the slip to his Arizona Department of Public Service security detail on the night of the sighting, joined a crowd of sky watchers at then Squaw Peak, and witnessed the V-shaped formations flyby. Symington repeated this tale via other media outlets in 2021. On the same episode of Showtime's UFO series I mentioned earlier, Symington claimed his reluctance to reveal that he witnessed the sightings was due to being under federal indictment at the time for 21 counts of extortion, bank fraud, and making false financial statements. So it just worked out for the secret government, or whatever, that this corrupt politician wanted to use the event to distract from his own crimes, and I'm sure both evil parties felt great about it. They probably did some kind of secret lizard handshake to celebrate their victory. The disgraced ex-governor was quoted as saying, "It was a fairly tumultuous time for me politically, and I certainly didn't want to pour any kerosene on the fire." He said, "So the next day, I kept my mouth shut." Later that year, he ended up being convicted on 7 counts of bank fraud, but the conviction was overturned on appeal in 1999. Surprised? A politician lied to all of us, right to our faces.
"You're a liar!"
Then was convicted of multiple crimes, and then had them all uncrimed because of his status. I'm sure that we would all be treated the same if we were in his situation, right? I like that new word I made up, by the way, uncrimed. I just want to repeat real quick that Fife Symington made at least 10% of Arizona residents and all UFO believers and researchers look stupid and crazy on national television. He did that mostly to distract us from his own crimes. It's a great example, and unfortunately just a drop in the bucket, for many, quote, UFO nuts and experiencers that have been treated like fools for years and years. There's a Phoenix Lights music festival now, and a found footage horror film called Phoenix Forgotten. So the idea of the Phoenix Lights is still being lampooned on a certain level to this day. I'm sure at one point they had Phoenix Lights themed drinks at regional Applebee's locations.
It's got to be, got to be, Applebee's.
UFOs, or UAPs as they call them these days, are in the mainstream news on a pretty regular basis now, which should feel validating for those of us who have been keeping track for years, but I can't help being skeptical of how it's all being presented. Just like Hollywood scared me and many others with Communion and Fire in the Sky in the 90s, they continue to try and scare everyone with the idea of aliens from outer space in wildly advanced crafts with the best form of manipulation available to date, our 24-hour news cycle. It's hard not to be scared of the unknown, and I can't think of a more extreme example of the unknown than the UFO phenomenon. That's why it's so fascinating to me. The more I read about the subject, the more it really does come full circle and involves occult practices and religion and way crazier stuff than just beings from another planet crashing their highly advanced crafts here all the time. Members of our intelligence agencies have even come forward with their own life-shattering experience tales. My current favorite case is the ongoing story of Chris Bledsoe, which I've referenced before. It's a fun time to be into aliens, let me tell you. You know what else is fun? Tying flies and catching fish with them. That is what this podcast is supposed to be about, after all. I saw a video recently that Loon Outdoors posted on their Instagram of Chris and some buddies fishing the canals of downtown Phoenix, and I was immediately intrigued. I shot Chris a DM, introduced myself, and we quickly set up a day to chat some more. I wanted to learn about desert canal carp. I wanted to know the secrets to the local sucker fishery. I wanted to know what Chris ties up to feed him. I wanted to know how he got into fishing these metro waterways. I wanted to learn about him and how he got to where he is now at the AZ Fly Shop. I really love fly shops, and I want to hear what they have going on over there. I had questions, and Chris had answers. Here's Chris and I getting to know each other.
Well, Chris, thanks for coming on the show, man. I appreciate you giving me an hour today. Loosely an hour. Sometimes we go over, sometimes we go under, but you know, I try.
We'll see where it
that's
goes.
That's what I shoot for with these things, yeah. Dude. And I've been wanting to do something a little different for this episode. And for a few days, I really couldn't escape social media pointing me in your direction. I saw something that Loon posted and about yourself and Low Water Guide Service. And I believe your shop was mentioned in there too. And it really got me following all your accounts, all those accounts. And then I saw Chad Alderson, who used to host the Barbless podcast, the Northern California podcast, like me, catching Metro Carp in your neck of the woods too, you know?
Yep.
And it was all kind of getting thrown in my face, and I was getting, my interest was piqued. And then, you know, lastly, there was a quote from you that kind of made me finally shoot you a message and get you on the show. And it was something along the lines of like, let's go hit the canals and then go get happy hour, you know.
Yeah.
Which is like, I love the attitude, man. So thank you. Thanks for coming on the show, man. Nice to meet you.
Thanks for having me. I really, really, really do appreciate it. I'm super excited for it.
Cool, man. Yeah. Nice to meet you virtually. This is how we do these things now. You know, I wish I could be in person and talk to you. Maybe that'll happen someday.
Absolutely.
But here we are, man. So are you sitting there at the AZ Fly Shop right now?
I am. Yep. I'm sitting right here in the front. It's just got the computer open and
cool, man. Yeah. How did you end up at the AZ Fly Shop? Like what put you in that spot?
Well, it's a funny story, actually. So I used to sell cars, and I was fairly successful, and I put myself in a really good position in life. A position where I was 30 years old and I don't have any kids and I'm not married. So I had financially put myself in a position where, you know, I just didn't have to work. I got some assets, things like that. And I didn't have to work anymore. So I quit selling cars because I hated it. And I started fly fishing all the time. And a guy named Chris Rich, he decided that he was going to open a fly shop. He started posting Facebook posts about it and things like that. Hey, I'm opening a fly shop in Phoenix. I'm opening a fly shop in Phoenix. So me being a fly tire, I came down to the location one day, or sent him a message. And I was like, hey, I want to come talk to you about some things. I want to talk to you about some like materials that I think you guys should have. Been a while since there was a good fly tying fly shop in Phoenix. There hasn't actually been one here since I've actually lived here. So I was like, I just need a place to buy materials. I need a place to buy good feathers and good good fur and things like that. So I came down here and he was like, hey, you know, we need help with some like construction stuff and placing orders and all kinds of just brand new fly shop stuff that nobody knew how to do. And honestly, neither did I, but I had the time to learn it. And then, you know, fast forward 8 months or so, he was like, hey, dude, do you want to just manage my shop? And I was like, oh, he said our shop, the Phoenix's shop. We're very adamant that this isn't our shop. We're just the stewards of the shop that belongs to the community here in Phoenix. And we really hold strong to that. But I was like, yeah, I'll do it. You know, it's insane. You're the city of 6.5 million people, and we're the only fly shop, standalone fly shop here in the Valley. So it's just been busier than we ever thought it would be.
And too cool. It's a ton of fun. That's awesome, man. Jumped right in the fire, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you born and raised out there?
No, I'm actually from Maryland originally. Okay. Yeah. I moved out here originally in 2011 for a girl. didn't work out.
Oh, man.
But I love the fact that it doesn't snow here in Phoenix. You know, I when I left, it was -9 and there was 2 feet of snow on the ground and I was miserable. So, yeah.
Well, you know, things happen for a reason, right? Mm-hmm. You ended up out there one way or another. And, you know, I was going to complain to you about how hot it is here in Sacramento. And then I remembered where you were and figured that you probably got me beat most of the time.
You know, it's hot. It's people are like, it's a dry heat. And I love when people say that. So is your oven. It is hot here.
They say that about Sacramento too. It's a dry heat. I mean, it's going to be 111 this weekend. You know, that's
yeah, right?
Hot. I don't care if it's hot or if it's wet heat or whatever. You know, it's still hot enough.
113 is 113, no matter how you slice.
Right.
I don't care.
So how did you get into tying flies and, you know, fly fishing and stuff? Was that something they caught on early, or is that like an adult thing? Like,
so I got into fly fishing early. I fished growing up my entire life. My grandfather was a commercial fisherman, owned a commercial fishing company, had a fleet of boats and things like that. I used to like conventional gear fish with him. And then I grew up in a little town called Northeast Maryland, and it's more water than blacktop. It's there's like 4,000 people in this entire town or something. And we just fished. That's what we did for fun. That's what we did for work. That's what we always did. We used to go out and I used to be a first mate on a couple of my grandfather's boats, and then I captained a couple of them and fish tournaments and things like that. But in that, I started fly fishing to try to just kind of make, I love the challenge of things. I always jumped at the opportunity for a challenge, and fly fishing, like, it made catching the bass in the little farm pond behind my grandparents' house twice as fun. Because it was just a little bit harder. And then, you know, fast forward, I like graduated high school, got into girls and things like that, kind of got out of fly fishing as much. And, you know, there were some other extracurricular activities going on and things like that.
Sure.
And, it's been on and off. I've never lost love for it. I always just come back to it. You know what I mean? Like, if life gets hard, I just need to go fishing. That's kind of how it's always been in my life. Fly tying is a total different thing. I can remember the day I decided I was going to tie flies. I was, it was actually while I was here, when I first moved here, I was fishing at a local fishery that's to the east side of Phoenix. It's called the Salt River. It's one of our tailwaters. They stock it with trout in the wintertime and everything. And there's a really good carp fishery and the sucker fishery that's absolutely phenomenal. I was on the Salt River, and this guy was like, he was telling me about this fly that you couldn't buy anymore. A guy named John Romer used to tie it. He lives in the White Mountains, blah, blah, blah. He does semi-seal is his material. And he's like, oh yeah, they don't commercially tie these flies anymore. It has a, you know, bright orange bead and yada, yada, you gotta tie them. I was like, oh, well, looks like I'll get a vise and some materials and stuff like that. And I want to tie this fly. That was the start of the addiction. I was done. I was absolutely done. I realized that it was much more about just tying flies than tying flies to fish. The artistic side
for me. Sure. Yeah. I mean, I've talked about it a bunch on the program. You know, there's, it's all the stress relief there, and the, I mean, there's tons of benefits to it. I mean, besides for the fun parts, you know, that are obvious, yeah. You know,
it's just addicting.
It is,
fly,
yeah.
Fly tying, and people say it's art, but when you really break it down, that's legitimately what it is. If you think about any kind of art, all art is supposed to do is to create a reaction in a person. Flies do the same thing. It's just we're targeting another species. That's it. We're trying to create a reaction in another species.
They make people go ooh and ah too. I mean, geeks like us, I guess. You know, people sell flies for big money, man. Framed
up. Oh, absolutely.
You know, yeah. That's cool. I mean, it sounds like you have like Waterman in your blood, and you ended up out here in Phoenix, but still found your way to the water one way or another. You know, ended up that way.
Absolutely.
That's cool, and it's the same draw for me. You know, fly tying, fly fishing. It's you got to be humbled. You know, like every once in a while, and the challenge of it is what keeps you going, right? Like the failure is motivating, and if it isn't, like you're in the wrong thing. You know, like it's not for you. So
absolutely,
yeah. Well, so when did you first encounter like fishing the canals out there in Phoenix? Then you know, like when is it?
So that's it's funny that it's a perfect segue because carp fishing is some of the most humbling things that you can do in freshwater. It's tough.
I feel like it's like a hand in hand with steelhead now. Like it's like if they're a steelheader, they're like into carp too. Like the more people I talk to.
I got a ton of flack when I opened up that loon video saying that trout don't take into your backing and all that stuff. I got eaten alive for it, but I'm not sorry. Cause I don't consider steelhead freshwater fish. They're anadromous. It's a different animal. It's a different animal, but yeah, it's, you know, a good day of carp fishing, you get two to eat. You might land one. You might.
Yeah.
And I tell people this all the time. They come in and they ask me about carp fishing and they're like, oh yeah, I can go, you know, to the golf course and catch as many as I want. You can try. Like that's.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if it's the steelhead fishing that I've done for, you know, most of my time fly fishing. I've always been happy with getting just one, you know, mm-hmm. It's also I guess it's also the fishery that I fish the most is the American River here in Sacramento. And it, like you were saying, a sucker fishery, that's probably the best thing that it has, here. And it's funny, you know, my first encounters with sucker fish were all negative. They were mostly gear fishermen and stuff that would drop kick them into the bushes or whatever, if they caught them. Right. And totally negative connotation, no matter what it was. And I catch so few fish here for a number of reasons. One, I'm not very good. There isn't very many fish here on my river, and you know, I don't fish as much as I'd like to. I can keep going, but I've come to appreciate catching a big old sucker fish, and I also love to like send those photos to my friends, you know, like the big old hog, nasty sucker fish.
Oh yeah,
you know, and make them laugh, make jokes about it, whatever. So like I dig it. It's funny. I've never heard somebody name out a sucker fishery.
So I started getting down on our sucker fish. Cause another thing, I was spending my life on the East Coast, and I fished an anadromous fish myself. I'm a striper guy. That's what I did my entire life. Cool. We call them rockfish in Maryland. And they were sea run, and they were giant stripers, People talk about their 30, 40 pounders all the time. I've seen people put 70 pounders on the boat multiple times.
Wow.
I grew up right on the Susquehanna Flats, and in my opinion, it's the world's greatest striper fishery.
We get big ones out here.
I
don't think I've heard of 70 pounders out here. I want to say I've heard of the 40 pounders and stuff on the Sac River and other tributaries out here. That's crazy.
my little brother back in May, he put four 60 pounders on the boat in one day. Yeah, they're giant. And it was right behind my mom's house, so it was easy. It's what my grandfather fished for his entire life. So by the time I started fishing them when I was, you know, 10 years old, I it was pre-dialed for me.
Is this like, I think I've seen videos on this before. Is this like a worm hatch?
Actually, no, we don't get the worms. There's a Lefty did an article about it, or a piece about it in one of his books, 101 Fish to Catch Before You Die, or whatever that mm-hmm. was called. The section on striped bass is, he talks about the Susquehanna Flats, and it's the Susquehanna River is one of the largest rivers that runs down the East Coast. It's the oldest river that runs down the East Coast, and it dumps directly into Chesapeake Bay. And the flats itself is this big sandbar that is just below the very first dam on the Susquehanna River. So it's as far as those big cow stripers can go when they leave the ocean to go spawn. And that's their stop. That's their last stop, is literally 100 yards from my mom's back door. And it's a special fishery. It's in trouble, just like everything else is, unfortunately. But there's still good fish there, and it's a lot of fun. I try to get back every year. This year, I was a little early. That's the problem with it. You can be 3 days early. You can just be 3 days early and not catch a thing.
So fishing the canals out there, have you been in, encountered any weird or sketchy situations? I mean, metro fishing, I get a little taste of it out here. Yeah. The American, like I was just mentioning, runs right through town, and it's, there's spots that are closer to, you know, the freeway and stuff than others, but you know, yeah. Have you had any crazy scenarios out there?
Me personally, I haven't had, I've seen things that I think are absolutely hilarious. I don't, like, I have never had anything like real crazy happen. There was one day when Buddy and I were fishing, and there were two guys in a literal rock fight. Like, they were throwing concrete chunks at each other on the other side of the canal, two homeless guys. I've seen, like, another buddy has a picture of, he's fighting this carp, and there's literally a dumpster fire behind him.
Oh, wow. That's a great photo.
It's quality.
Dude, you got to send me that if you have it.
I'd love absolutely. I'll have to grab it from him.
You know what's weird this year, and it's something at least unique, and I've been fishing the American for about 10 years or so here in Sacramento, the lower American River, and I saw on three different occasions this year people crossing the river with bicycles, like just kind of walking the bike through. And it wasn't just like, you know, 2-inch, 3-inch riffle water or something like that. It was like they were up to the top straight bar of the bike. I don't know. I hadn't seen that before, but I saw it on three different times this year, and the water was low. Pretty low during, you know, most of the year, but like I said, not in super shallow spots where you're just kind of walking through like a puddle or something like that. They're wading through the river in different spots with bikes. It was a little weird.
You get every time you go out, it's like, oh, what are you fishing for? And then I'm like, oh, carp. And then they're like, the next question, you don't eat those, do you? That's the very next question every single time, which is fine. It's like, yeah, it gives me the chance to talk to people and like talk about the urban fishery and why it's special and things like that. Like, no, we don't eat them, but the reason I carp fish is I grew up doing the whole saltwater thing. I did tuna and billfish for a long time too. I like trout and everything. They're in beautiful places. They're pretty little fish. I like to hear my reel go off.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, carp show me my backing knot just about every time.
It's funny that is the question that people who don't fish ask anglers. The most, right, is something about eating the fish, and they're usually pretty surprised when you say you don't. But there is a large group of us who kind of just mess with them, And I, you know, I don't know. I like eating fish too. I'll take a saltwater fish home if I catch one for sure. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I if I'm out in blue water, if I'm a, you know, like I hook a yellowfin, it's getting a gas. The thing is getting stuck. That's what's happening. So,
working at the shop, are you seeing people like traveling from out of state to the Phoenix area to fish the canals and stuff like that? Is that becoming a thing that people are destination coming out to the area to fish?
Absolutely. It's it's starting to and it helps that like we have some guys that really talk highly about it, and like Jeff Currier and Tim Johnson and like those kinds of guys that are out, and they're very, very accomplished anglers, and I fished with these guys, and they talk very highly about our fishery out here. And we love it. I want people to come here and come fish these canals, and like I want people to realize how special this is and everything. It's good for everything. It's good for the community. It gives you more, like it just broadens everything. More importantly for me though, why I push carp as heavily as I do, and why I'm so like a big reason I'm so enthralled with it is if I can show people how awesome this thing, this carp fishing thing really, really is, and how much fun it is, how challenging it is, it might take a couple people off of those trout streams that desperately need less pressure. Like,
for sure. Yeah, that's cool.
You know, if we can keep a couple people a day off of a little trout stream, that helps. It just helps. So.
Well, it's exciting. I mean, like I think I said before we started recording, like the reason the way I found you was through that loon video, or I might have mentioned it while we've been recording. I can't remember anymore. But it's exciting. It's cool. It's in an odd spot. It's seemingly in a place far away from, you know, beautiful fly fishing, you know, the idea of beautiful fly fishing and catching monster carp and looking like you're having a blast, and close enough to town where, like you said, you can go get a drink and, you know, have a short kind of fish mission out there, which I appreciate. And, you know, like I said, I've always been kind of cool with one, you know, or two or something, whatever, but like, I like coming home, leaving the river still happy about what just happened out there. Like, it's, I don't know, you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to get one and then fail all day long and then leave, you know,
like, wanting more. Just I have to feel like I've either learned something or there's something else there that needs to be figured out. Like, I love that. I love the whole, like, trying to figure it out thing. And carp fishing in general is still pretty new. There's guys out here that have paved the way, and I have to give a shout out to guys like Josh Johnson. I play Flyfish AZ on Instagram. He's absolutely the carp king out here. It's no question. Casey Badger paved the way for him. Like, the Redding Pro is awesome.
I'll link to those guys in the show notes and stuff too, for sure. Has the city taken notice to this? And they're starting to push it and promote the idea of fishing the canals, and that's cool.
It's what's really funny is the president of SRP, which they physically own the carp. They physically own our grass carp. They use them as pool cleaners, kind of for the canal. Okay, sure. They're sterile, theoretically sterile. And they put them in there. They put, you know, about 30,000 of them in there a year or something like that. And they own them. They own the water rights and things like that. The president is a fly fisher. And he comes in regularly. He's getting ready to go to a trip to Australia and stuff. So I just saw him the other day, and he loved it. I talk to him about it all the time, and he absolutely loves it. So they're supportive for the most part. There's still some gray area because, you know, it's they're used to dealing with a different side of the population on the canals. The people who tend to frequent canal banks regularly are just. There's a lot of homelessness. There's a lot of like
Any Metro River is the same way. It's same, yeah. Same here. Yep.
Yeah. So we're just trying to give, they're working with us more and more. They're starting, they don't know much about us and how we act out there, what we do. Like, there's the other thing too. Most of the people in the city still think that you don't fish unless you eat them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's a lot of that too.
That's cool, man. That's cool that the city's accepting it, you know, and like and pushing that. And like I said, I've kind of learned to embrace the quick fish mission. I have two young kids, and I'm lucky. I live real close to the American River here, and although I complain about it, it's right there for me when I can sneak in an hour or two. And yeah. You know, whatever happens in that hour or two, I appreciate either way. So I like the idea of this being right there for a lot of people who live, you know, in town, and being able to get out and get out of the hustle and bustle, and that, you know, whatever you get out of fishing for an hour or two close, yeah, by, absolutely. That's cool. So is time flies for fishing carp for in the canals. Is there any sort of specific materials that you might, is there something different, you know, that you might use in that scenario that you would be in a different carp fishery, or?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Our carp out here are kind of trained to eat a little bit differently. We don't have the same, we have this misconception that we don't really have a lot of water. We do. We like there is actually a fair amount of water here in Arizona. We have hundreds of miles, but our carp here are a little bit different. We have grass carp, which other places have grass carp, but we don't have all the things that they tend to eat regularly. Like, we don't have cottonwoods. We don't have mulberries. We don't have any of that kind of stuff. So tying flies for grass carp is a little bit different than other places. You still tie kind of the same kinds of patterns, but what I've found is grass carp are very, very, very picky. If they're eating something yellow and size, you know, 12 on top of the water, they're not going to eat something that's tan and a size 14. They just won't do it. It's kind of like, so it is very specific to what it is that they're eating. Like, I tie a lot of like bougainvillea flowers and things like that. Palo Verde, pollen balls. And
what was the first one that you mentioned that you cut out a little bit on that first one you mentioned?
Bougainvillea flowers. They're just like a pink and like a fuchsia and white flower. And they blow in off the trees, and then the carp come up and eat them.
Cool.
So we tie a lot of those, but we also fish a lot of blow bugs, but we float them. And a lot of like San Juan worms, but in like chartreuse and caddis and colors like that, that kind of look like grass or moss.
Yeah. You know, I saw you posting a tie-in video with an interesting looking kind of chenille called chewing gum worm, which, yes, I hadn't seen. Right. Is there anything you could share about that? Like, what's cool about that? I like finding new materials. I was just geeking out with Jim Sens on my last episode about Kraken dubbing.
Yeah.
I've talked about a couple times on the show. It's dubbing, but it's got a couple little unique factors to it, mm-hmm, that make it cool. And what's the deal with this
chewing gum?
Yeah.
So those guys from FNF Fly Fishing, they're out of the UK somewhere. They are awesome, and they're doing some materials that are just wild. What I really like about that material, it's basically rubber legs, like flexi floss rubber legs, and dry fly dubbing that's spun into a chenille. If you leave it kind of like hanging off like a tail, it never stops moving in the water. It wants to float so bad, and it just kind of wiggles and undulates and keeps moving, but it's super easy to tie with. You lose a lot of flies fishing for carp. There's a ton of stuff in the water, and sure, and they're big and they break you off, and you throw a light tippet and things like that. So it's nice to have a fly that you can tie four dozen of in an hour, and a one material fly with a set of dumbbell eyes is
not. Yeah. Oh, dude, I watched a video, and it was so quick, and it looked so cool. Mm-hmm. Just right off, you know, mm-hmm, You don't see a lot of those as that simple. I mean, super quick and easy. That one looks versatile. It could be a lot of different things. I'm sure hook size is probably varying a lot, but is there a hook type that you prefer? Are you fishing mostly jig hooks out there? What are you doing for?
I personally like targeting common carp more. I think they pull harder. They're just a little more, they're a little tougher to get to eat consistently. That, and it's more like flats fishing, which is my favorite thing in the entire world. I love flat. I love the flats. I love saltwater flats. I love big bone fish, permit, and all that stuff. It's my favorite thing in the world. And common carp eat the kind of the same way as like bonefish and permit do. So I tend to target those the most. And for them, it's all jig style. You want that hook to stand straight up off the bottom and things like that. I personally, Joe Mathis over at Firehole has his 520, and it's phenomenal. It's the best carp hook I've ever used.
You say Firehole 520, it's a jig hook?
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. I use them in 8s and 12s mostly, kind of depending on the flies that I'm tying and everything. But yeah, he's got a great hook. A couple of the partridge hooks are awesome. A-Rex makes a couple really good jig hooks too. But I personally use a lot of the 520s, and I know a couple other guys that do too. Well, they're really good carp fishermen just because they stand straight up.
Yeah. Awesome. Have you or your buddies like developed any specific patterns for the fish in the canal? Is there something unique, like, or a twist on a common carp fly that you guys like? Or?
Oh, absolutely. All of us. We all fish common with like carp specific fly. We tie stuff that, like, I tie a lot of dragonfly nymphs, and there's a lot of our game and fish biologists out here are also fly fishermen, and one of them in particular, he's a ridiculous fly tier and a great angler as well, and loves carp fishing. But we tie a lot of dragonfly nymphs, but on a heavier hook than your standard trout hooks, so they don't get bent out and things like that. Damselfly nymphs, but on heavier style hooks, so they don't bend out. And but yeah, we basically take, because especially common carp, they eat the same things trout do. They eat damselflies and damselfly nymphs and dragonfly nymphs and crayfish and leeches and things like that.
Are trout eating flowers and stuff though? I mean, like,
no,
dude,
no.
That's so, it's so cool. Like, I feel like that's, yeah. I like the idea of just tying up stuff that's not a bug or a fish too. I just want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure I'm one of the only ones that's tying bogus via flowers. I know nobody's doing it commercially.
Well, I see like the tropical stuff, or I can't remember what it was, but like people are tying fruit, you know, pieces of fruit and stuff. I can't remember what they were for even, but I've definitely seen that.
I think it starts with an M. I think that fish that's in South America.
It sounds familiar. Yeah.
Yes.
I can't remember what it was, but that stuff's super cool. Just avant-garde. It's just something different, you know?
And that stuff works too. Like, especially when the olive trees are out here dropping olives and things like that, we tie little foam balls.
Super cool. So yeah. Would you be able to tell me like a top five, like top five flies for fish in the canals? Like what would you have, you know, if you had to pick five?
So they're different though, because there's five common carp flies and five grass carp flies. Common carp and grass carp eat completely differently. So it's hard to target both at once. Top five grass carp flies, we'll start there. Chartreuse glow bug is probably number one. Chartreuse glow bug, just floating on it, float it to them. They'll eat it a lot. Chartreuse San Juan worm, unweighted, is probably number two. I fish it underneath the chartreuse glow bug, like a hopper dropper style. And it gets eaten. I fish a lot of bougainvillea flowers. That's probably number four. And then I call it the CGS. It's the Crystal Garden Special. It's a fishery out here. It's a like a local chain of ponds that has a bunch of koi and stuff in it. I fish that for grassies a lot. And then my last one is kind of weird. You also swing for grassies out here, like their steelhead. I tie a like an intruder style, like spun deer hair head, just straight up swing.
Are you swinging them with two-handed rods? Or what are you doing?
No, I swing them with a 10-foot five weight. I fish a Scott Centric 10-foot five weight for grassies a lot. Cool. Fish is like a six weight. It's a downstream, 45 downstream men get the
swing. It sounds like a stout trout spay would be perfect for something like that.
Yeah. It is. The only problem that I have with a lot, even the lightest trout spay, like even a 3-weight trout spay is like a 7-weight line hitting the water.
Sure. Yeah.
Our fish just don't deal with that. They just don't like that. You will spook less fish throwing a true single hand 6.
Yeah. I hear you. Even with a lighter Scandi head on there, maybe.
Yeah.
The big heavy Skagit heads will totally splash down and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe I've played around with it a little bit, and it probably has something to do with my lack of ability with the two-hand rod. I just never really got into them, and I still don't have much experience, and I fish them a lot on the still water out here for trout, but that's about the extent of it. It's probably has a lot to do with my ability too. But even on a 6-weight, I'm still throwing 14-foot leaders, and a lot of times it's still not enough.
Crazy. It's
still not enough. They're spooky fish.
We almost forgot, but let's get the 5 flies for the common carp too, then. You already did the grass carp, right?
Five flies for the common carp. My number one fly for common carp, it's a dragonfly nymph. It's like a kind of a mock hybrid dragonfly nymph that I tie. And then number two is probably my Crystal Garden special again. I catch a lot of commons on that too. You can have your eyes on it and get it to the bottom. And then really any kind of hybrid worm pattern, like any of the carp specific carpalicious or whatever, any of the carp specific hybrid worm pattern, they do pretty well. Color is a big thing. So you just gotta play with it until you get the right one. Black leeches and black woolly buggers, they just crush it. They'll catch every fish in the water. It doesn't matter where it's swimming. So
love a leech, dude. It's my favorite.
Yep. Yeah, love them. And I tie a couple common carp flies that are, I make them more complicated than they need to be just for me. I tie a carp slider that's got spun deer hair head on it. Sure. And like, it's just fun for me to tie.
Yeah. Wait, so, cool, man. That's cool. Yeah. Are the canals a year-round fishery? I mean, are you fishing year-round out there?
Yeah. We're fishing them year-round. The winter, it gets kind of slow. The carp love the heat. They love the heat up until about 113 degrees. In the winter, they tend to kind of slow down a little bit, and they're not as active, but they can still be caught. And I mean, you get a couple warm days in a row, which is not uncommon out here in the middle of January. You can get 4 days in a row that are 75 degrees. We catch them pretty well, actually. But it does slow down a little bit, never stops. And then in the winter, we also got our sucker fishery too. So
nice. The sucker fishery, dude. I love it.
Absolutely. Love it
so much, dude. What about gear in general for like an evening mission on the canals? Like, you might not need a waiting staff maybe, but what are you bringing out there that's not your common, maybe something unique for fishing that area?
Water. lot of it. It's stay hydrated out here. That's just really all it is. I don't carry really anything that special. I use a big net from Walmart. most of the time, and we're not even, it's funny, we don't even sell them in the shop. We don't have a distributor for them, so we're just like, go get them at Walmart, they're the best.
Yeah, I think I noticed that on the videos that I've been watching. You guys have long handle big nets.
They're usually collapsible. But
just tends to be like a longer reach from where you're fishing. It doesn't look like you're wading a lot, right? You're typically,
you're not allowed to be in the canal.
Okay, I didn't know that. All right.
Yeah, and like you're not supposed to be. I've gotten in them to land some fish before. Sure. It's not exactly the place you want to be in either.
Right, like, right.
You got to really want to land that fish. That, you know, it's got to be a 20 plus pounder to even consider, like, not just losing it. If it's not 20 pounds, I'm just going to lose it. That's just what's going to happen. It's gross. You never smell good after coming out of the canal.
Yeah, that's funny. So, well, I think I already know the answer to this, because I was going to ask you, but I know that you haven't been in Arizona incredibly long. Talk a lot about other weird stuff on my show, not just fly fishing and fly tying, you know, like UFOs and, you know, Bigfoot and all the other weird stuff. And the Phoenix Lights is like a famous UFO sighting out there. It happened in 97. Do you have any, you weren't out there by that back
then? No, I wasn't. It's funny you should say that though, because I'm the kind of guy that loves to just explain everything, like, oh yeah, that, you know, this is probably this, that's probably a weather balloon, that's probably you know, that kind of stuff. I had never had anything happen to me where I'm like, oh, I have no idea what that is. That's completely unexplainable until I moved out here.
Oh man, really? I was good. Yeah. Okay. Well, I ask every one of my guests if they have any weird paranormal type stories, and I think you're going to have to tell me one now. What happened?
So it was funny. I was hanging out with a buddy of mine, and, you know, we were having some drinks and stuff, hanging out at his house, and another buddy calls us, and he lives like 10 minutes up the street. And he's like, dude, you guys got to get over here. He's like, there's something in the sky, you know, blah, 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 blah. I have no idea what this thing is. Can you guys see it from where you're at? And so we're out like standing on the wall behind his house, like trying to see whatever it was. And we finally get into his car and drive up to my buddy's house. And as soon as we were getting ready to pull into his neighborhood, I look out the windshield and I can see this thing in the sky. It was this round thing, and it had different colored lights all the way around it, but it was like yellow on the outside, then the next ring was blue, then the next ring was red, then the next ring was green, and it just kind of, and they would like pulse out and then back in and then go around it. It had no pattern, like set pattern to it, and it was like close, like I could see every individual light, and it was moving sideways and up and down and all kinds of other stuff. And we got into his neighborhood, and there was like 35 people out there. There's like just standing in the neighborhood, like
all watching it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, and people were trying to get clear pictures, and everybody's calling the news and things like that. And then I just never heard anything about it. Like a news station called my buddy's mom the next day. I can't remember which one, but he told me about it, and then nothing else. But it was the weirdest thing. It kind of went west and kept getting higher, and then eventually moved off west, and then just disappeared just over the skyline.
Crazy.
And never heard anything else about it, but it was the craziest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, you were part of like a small, well, kind of a mass sighting, like mass public sighting, I guess, about 30, 40 people or something.
Yeah. Oh, it was probably 30 people out there.
That's crazy. I explained my sighting on my last episode that I had with my wife, and it was just the two of us. So a lot of the time it feels like you're crazy. You have this validation though, when you have a bunch of other people around there seeing the same thing. I remember seeing other people out on the street when I had mine, and seeing if they were looking up at it too, and going like, hey, like, wanting to say, hey, do you see this, and not saying that.
Yeah.
But then always wondering if anybody ever did, never really finding out. But
there was like, I mean, we were just, there was, you know, 25 people standing in the middle of the street.
Yeah.
Car stopped. It was wild. It really was wild.
You have a vivid memory?
Oh, absolutely. Never forget it.
What it looks like and stuff. That's cool. Would you say that it looked more like something mechanical or something kind of like weirder than that?
It was definitely mechanical. It moved unlike anything. Like, that was the thing. I was like, maybe it's something that, like, maybe it's somebody's drone, or maybe it's, and like I said, I'm the type of person that tries to rationalize things as much as physically possible.
Sure. Yeah.
And it got down to the fact where I was just like, it could have been somebody's drone, but it's the size of a 747. It's just not a realistic thing.
When you say it was moving, what do you mean? Like, what was the weird movement? So it was just like a jerky, like non-conventional flight maneuvers. What do you mean?
Yeah. It was going up and down in altitude and then left to right and then north to south. Like it could move in literally any direction. That's like kind cool. of like a drone would do, but if a drone was the size of a 747.
I've been reading deep on UFOs and stuff like that for so long, dude. Like, it feels like forever now. It's probably been 20 years or something. I don't know, maybe longer. Yeah. Just kind of really into the subject and being very open-minded about it. My own opinion about what that phenomenon is has changed a lot, many times over the years. And I kind of really struggle the most, I guess, with that distinction of people's sightings of them being like, this is a vehicle that's flying in the air. That's obviously, you know, a mechanical thing, tangible mechanical object. And then sightings that are so much more bizarre than that. And like, so what's the difference between those two things? And I don't know, that's kind of an area that I really dig into. So that's cool. It's cool to hear yours, man. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Haven't had one of those on the show yet. Have you been out to Sedona or any of the weird spots out there where, people talk personally, about all this, you know, weird stuff happening?
Personally, I there is a fishery in Sedona. It's Oak Creek.
Oh, yeah.
And I try to stay away from it as much as physically possible. It is busy. It's really busy. And it's busy without a lot of fishing going on. So it's a good place to be fishing. And then tennis ball followed by a golden retriever jumps right into the hole.
Yeah.
Things like that, which I don't have a problem with. It's public water. I will just choose to fish it when they're not there.
That's yeah. Another reason why I appreciate the quick, 1 to 2 hour fish mission, you find those spots where nobody else is out there, because that's when you got to do it and avoid the dogs. I love dogs too. I'm a dog guy, but I don't want them out there fishing.
I know, right? It's like, yeah, and I have no problem with, I'm not saying like, oh, they're doing something bad or whatever. It's not my creep. They can enjoy it too, and I'm glad they're out there enjoying it. I'll just go fish somewhere.
Yeah, for sure. Man, the canal sounds so cool. Do you have like a crew of people that like that hold it special? Like, is there like a growing crew of you guys that's going out and doing this thing? And
absolutely.
Have you guys I propose some kind of, like, if you don't have it already, like some kind of canal grand slam where like you get all the whatever you can get out there, and it has to be, but those have to be caught on flies that you tie made from garbage found at that canal.
Let's go even deeper. I like that. I like that idea. We as a shop, so every state has their slams and things like that. Including Arizona, we've got a trout challenge. Us as a shop, Chris and I have kind of really decided that we're gonna do a warm water slam. We're gonna do an urban slam. We have a ton of species here that, like, we have plecos, and I caught a Oscar tiger cichlid the other day. It was like 16 and a half inches long. And then the carp, and we've got, you know,
you mentioned koi and all these other things.
Yep,
too.
Koi. You can catch, if you scroll through my Instagram at any point, you can see the we've caught big colored up koi and goldfish. Nice. and everything. I mean, it's everything. So you can literally catch 12 different species out of the canal. It's a lot of fun. Bass, It's all in there. Catfish. I've caught a bunch of flathead catfish. I'm still trying to catch a big one. I've caught a bunch of them.
Yeah. Cool, man. So do you have any like is there any like regular or upcoming events, like tying events at the shop you got going on? Anything cool coming up?
Absolutely. Every Thursday night, every single Thursday night, we do a fly tying meetup. I host it. It's my baby. It is glorified beer drinking is what it actually is. And it's just a bunch of people that just want to come hang out and talk about fly fishing. Like during football season, we have football on and we usually have pizza and it's two beers for every fly you tie.
This sounds cool.
But I just wanted being in the shop 6 days a week, 5-6 days a week, I still wasn't talking about fishing enough. So I wanted to spend a couple hours every week without, running the register and just hang out with the people that come in and talk about fly fishing and it not in a store setting. Just come in, hang out with me, talk about fly fishing, and maybe tie a fly or two. And if you're new, we'll help you. If you've been tying for 100 years, come tie for 100 years and help the guy that's new, like that kind of thing. And we'll bounce ideas off of each other. And then we make friendships, like a couple guys that I met at the fly tying night. They came in and kind of one of the guys just moved here and everything. We went out to Miami and we caught trophy bonefish for a week. And it was just on a whim. We were like, let's go DIY this. And it was cool. Like you just meet a lot of really good friends.
Way cool, man. That sounds super cool. I'm sure it's like that with most people that are, really into whatever hobby, but fishermen, I think, want to talk with other fishermen. My wife always tells me pilots are the same way, but like it makes my day fishing, when I'm done fishing, I'm packing up at the car. If like an old grumpy dude comes by and wants to chat about what I just did out there. Like that's the icing on the cake for me.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So thanks for coming and talking to me, dude, coming on the show. And I feel like I kind of blindsided you a little bit with this interview. And I appreciate you being so open to coming on and talking shop with a stranger. And
I love it. And, I love it. That's why I do.
Cool, man. Yeah. And I'm a curious dude. And when I see something unique like what you have out there, I want to learn more. And I also saw it as a good excuse to talk about a famous UFO case. And look, I didn't have... you didn't have anything about that case, but I got your own sighting out of it, which is pretty cool. So thanks again, man. And
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there. And dude, you got to come out. We've got like the owner and I, we've got access to like Airbnbs and stuff like that. Come out for a few days and come fish with us. It's like, I don't hold a guide's license. I also don't charge people to fish with them or take them out fishing.
Cool, man.
You just come fish with us. We've got a carp rally. It's like our tournament. It's coming up September 23rd and 24th. And we've got a lot of cool prizes. The companies are coming out of the woodwork to support us. Abel, Ross, Scott, Loon, Firehole, Echo. We've got prizes from all of them. I've got guide trips that I'm giving away. Bow River, everywhere. It's going to be a lot of fun, and it's all to benefit. The other cool thing about the shop, we are community first. In our first 30 or first year, we raised almost $30,000 for local charities, and that was all because of this community. And we gave them an outlet, and they just poured money into the community, and it's absolutely special.
Way cool. I love it, dude.
Supported things like Homeless ID Project and Casting for Recovery and all that stuff. And it's been just absolutely phenomenal how much the community's come out and supported those things.
Well, like Sacramento, it seems like Phoenix is kind of rough in that department. Homelessness and all that kind of stuff. Same here in Sacramento. And it's cool to hear that you guys are trying to do something about it. Way cool.
ID project is something that's very, 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 very near and dear to us. The guy who owns it is the president of the project and everything. And Yeah, it's the step one to ending homelessness is getting an ID. You need it to get a job, you need it to get housing, you need it to get anything. And most of these people don't have a birth certificate. They have no idea where it was or where it is or anything. And giving them the tools to be able to get out there and get an identification so they can change their lives, that it means the world to me. So I'm happy to support it. You know,
cool, man. That kind of stuff, yeah. I'll link to that in the show notes too, dude.
Absolutely.
And you're going to see me knocking on your shop door one of these days. I'm going to come out there and fish.
Got to, man. You got to come out for carp season, and got to come out for the sucker season too. I've mentioned it a couple of times. I got to tell you about it. The Sonora sucker. It's one of our native species of sucker out here. The IGFA world record is from here. The catch and release record was just broken again. There's shots at IGFA world records every day out here, and they're like a carp, but they eat more. It's like the difference between a redfish and a permit.
it sounds weird to say, but I think I'm gonna fly to another state to go catch sucker fish.
Let's go. Let's go.
Cool, man.
Well, how about that? I got my first UFO story from a guest, and of course it happened on the episode where I rambled about UFOs the most. Big thanks to Chris for joining me and sharing that story, along with all the fishing stuff we got into. I say this about every place that I've highlighted on this show, and about every guest, but I'm going to do my best to get out to Phoenix to meet Chris in person and fish the canals. I need to get off my big butt.
Everyone I know has a big butt.
And make a list of the new fishing friends I've made and get out to shake their hands in person. Start checking them off my list. It's the only way I can get things done anymore. I'm very grateful that these folks all agree to waste an hour talking to me over the internet. I might be jinxing myself, but no one said no yet. I might be ignored every once in a while, but no one said, yeah, right, weirdo, and then blocked me for asking.
So I got that going for me, which is nice.
I'm very grateful for anyone out there listening too. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope to see you next time. Stay tuned for some words about organizations that are very much not sponsors of this show. Cast Hope is a nonprofit organization positively impacting kids and their mentors in California and Western Nevada through free fly fishing and outdoor experiences. Through their program, clients build mentoring relationships, fly fishing skills, outdoor knowledge, sustainable practices, and personal values. Cast Hope's gift of the outdoors empowers each mentoring pair to grow closer as they participate in healthy hobbies together. Check them out at casthope.org and whichever social network you like to use. Wild Steelheaders United was established to educate and mobilize the numerous wild steelhead advocates. It's a place where anglers can become more informed about wild steelhead biology and ecology, keep abreast of policy issues, and learn about Trout Unlimited's conservation work. As demonstrated by history, it's certainly possible to rally conservation-minded steelhead anglers to weigh in on specific management decisions that threaten to eliminate something they value. But there is no precedent for advancing a proactive, sustainable policy agenda at scale through purely volunteer efforts. Chances of conservation success are greatest if we have the backing of as many individuals as possible across all the Pacific states. This is why Wild Steelheaders United is critical. Visit wildsteelheaders.org for more info.
This episode of the Secret Society of Fly Tires is brought to you by generous donations from people like you. Do you want to support the show? Do you want to make a difference in the lives of fish and fishermen everywhere? Well, just send us a bunch of money. You could do it in the mail, the mailbox, probably. I don't know. Have we got a mailbox set up? No? We'll put a bunch of money in a box and mail it to us, and hopefully we'll have everything set up before it gets here. Thanks. This episode of the Secret Society of Fly Tires is brought to you by the Bristol Brand Throat Spray. Listen to me. Listen to my voice. I use Bristol Brand Throat Spray, and you can tell. You can hear it in my smooth, creamy tones. Can't you? Can't you? Bristol Brand Throat Spray is a soothing spray that is great for when you've got a cough or allergies or you're just tired. Take a huff whenever you'd like. I don't care. Just buy it, okay?
Please note that this is not a real advertisement, and the company, brand, entity, or product mentioned in the preceding ad in no way endorses, agrees with, or knows about this podcast.